Between the Lines with Andrea Gilligan. This is News Talk.
You're welcome along to News Talk's Between the Lines programme with myself, Andrea Gilligan, where we'll be taking a closer look at some of the main stories and issues of interest. Thanks to everyone for getting in contact regarding our last episode discussing the issue of children's health and fitness, the rise of obesity in Ireland, and the provision of services and physical education in our schools. You can still listen back to the podcast on newstalk.com or in iTunes. And as always, you can get in contact with us today by emailing betweenthelines@newstalk.com or on Twitter at myself at Andrea Gilligan. Well, today we're continuing our series with regards to the Irish education system, and today's focus is the Irish third level sector. We'll be looking at a few issues related to Irish universities and also asking how things can be improved right across the sector. So to discuss our panel this morning, we're joined by the Associate Professor from the UCD School of Maths and Statistics, Maria Meehan, also education journalist and former advisor to Rory Quinn when he was Education Minister, John Walsh, and we're also joined by Pádraig Walsh, who's the CEO of QQI Quality and Qualifications Ireland. You're all very welcome to the programme and thanks for joining us today. Can I just maybe start perhaps with yourself, if you don't mind, Maria. There's lots of different areas that we're going to discuss over the course of today's programme, but I just want to ask you about, just from your own kind of professional experience, that transition period from second to third level and how Irish students actually fare out when they make that move to whether it be an IT or a university here in Ireland.
Well, I think the first thing is that the area of research that I'm interested in, which is maths education at the third level, there's a lot of research there specifically on the mathematical transition. And one of the things that's talked about is that really the transition is a four-year period. It's good to consider it not as a single point in time. So it's really the 2 years before the student comes into third level, so the final 2 years of secondary school, and then the first 2 years of third level as well. So it's actually, you can think of it as this sort of in two parts, the first 2 years and the second 2 years. And then I think within that, you have sort of what the student and the individual needs to do in the first 2 years as they're thinking about going to college. And then when they actually get their place, what they should do to as best they can make a success of it. And of course, the institutions as well play a big role in advising the students and also in the structures that we put in place to support them both before they come to us and then when they're with us as well.
And that's something we will focus on, I suppose, a little bit later in the programme too today, in terms of kind of the retention rates at third level, and very specifically maybe in your own field and in the engineering sector as well. But how do you see, like, and just even in terms of kind of from a quality standard perspective, when you get the students at UCD in your maths and stats department, and how are they? How are they equipped to deal with what's going to come before them?
On the whole, the students that we get in, and I find this more and more in the past few years, they seem to be very well briefed on what they're getting into, so particularly in the maths and stats and science area. And they've often really researched the degree quite well. But one of the things in our area that we've done, and I think it works really well, is that we have, say, in science, a general entry to science. So it's one degree, it's one way in, but we have actually 26 different degree programmes in it. And the whole point about this, and I think this is what works really well for our students, is that when they come in, they can choose to explore different areas of science, maybe pick up science they hadn't done at school, or they can specialise. And then at the end of their first year, we ask them, well, now, don't pick your degree just yet. Narrow it down. What's your area? Maybe look at two or three different degrees you're interested in. Follow those. And it's only at the end of second year that they actually commit to the degree programme. So I think this is working out really well for us, because it shows the students have a chance to taste things before they actually choose.
Okay.
And then we've other things, like, I know mathematics is always mentioned in the transition to university, because it really pervades most of the programmes at third level. So we, for example, have a math support centre. We set it up in 2004. It's a free drop-in math centre. Any first or second year student can go there. And for example, last year we had 6,000 visits to it. So it's open over 42 hours a week.
And is it kind of like a grind support?
No, it's the whole idea is the student goes to lectures, they go to their tutorials or their labs, and then if they still have a quick question, they go and they just get one-on-one help. But it's very much geared towards, and I think this is the key for students in the transition, helping them become the independent learner. So helping them take control and helping them make that's a big thing for them in the transition.
Can I bring you in perhaps, John Walsh, on some of this, just in your own kind of professional background, obviously working in the education arena as a journalist, but just what's your view on that kind of transition period?
Well, before I talk about that, I might just say that this discussion is very timely because it comes after a number of reports over the past few weeks on the completion rate and the dropout rate, indeed, from third level courses, on how graduates, our Irish graduates, are faring in the employment market. And there have been a number of discussions and seminars over the past week or so looking at the whole post-secondary scenario, you know, further education, higher education. There was a consultation organised by the Minister for Higher Education, Mary Mitchell O'Connor, and the Minister for Education, Joe McHugh, at which they outlined their thinking of the future of further and higher education. So this is really timely. But the transition from second to third level is problematic for some young people. It can be difficult for some, but there have been a number of changes over the past few years to make it a little bit easier in terms of a new point system, a new grading system. And also, I mean, I have to commend UCD for having a broad entry into science. It was one of the first, UCD was one of the first to have this broad entry, because when it's difficult for a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old, indeed, to decide, well, look, I want to do a very specific type of science or engineering or whatever at that age. So to have a broad entry for a year, which was something when Rory Quinn was in office, he was pushing in a big way. At the time, the number of course options had been rising exponentially. I mean, a few years ago, there were 300 or 400. There's now about 1,400 different choices, over 1,400 on the CAO system. So it's really a bit confusing for some students. So the idea of a broad entry was, we thought, a good idea, and I commend UCD on being one of the first to introduce that.
Can I bring you in perhaps, Padraig Walsh, at this point, just to explain to people, what is QQI, Quality and Qualifications Ireland? What is it that you do?
We're the body responsible for quality assurance of all post-secondary education. So that includes the PLC courses in the Education and Training Boards, the universities, institutes of technology, the private colleges. We're also responsible for the National Framework of Qualifications. People will recognise the 10-level framework where you have, say, the Honours Bachelor's degree at level 8, etc. on that. We're involved in apprenticeships because they straddle the two of those as well. We provide recognition advice on Irish qualifications and foreign qualifications. And we're also actually the awarding body for further education and training. So you actually get your certificate. If you do a PLC course from QQI, you also get your certificate from QQI if you're in one of the private higher education colleges.
Okay, so are you effectively, just in layman's terms, basically the body that approves the course that you go on to complete at UCD or NUIG or whatever?
The public higher education institutions, what are termed self-awarding bodies, so they award their own qualifications. But we quality assure the institution as a whole. So we don't look at the individual programme level for the universities and IOTs. We do that in the private colleges and in the further ed colleges.
Okay. We've been talking, I suppose, today in terms of that kind of the outset of the programme, the transition period for students from second into third level and indeed PLC and other postgraduate programmes. Just from your own kind of perhaps experience, how do you see students being equipped to deal with the knowledge base and the skill set and the type of learning that's required quite often within the third level sector?
As Maria's already mentioned, there is a transition. And one of the most useful things that was set up is that the Department of Education actually have what's called a transition steering group that has worked for the last 4 years. They're the body that looked at and oversaw the change in the point system. They're the body that also looked at the research on, for instance, the broad entry system that Maria talked about and that John talked about, that Rory Quinn had been piloting when he was minister. So all of the bodies that are involved in the second level and third level system, all the agencies and the department are involved there, because we were concerned at that particular transition. It matters more when a greater number of people go on to higher education, because obviously that's almost not become the, it's become the norm now than was before. There is a challenge in going from second level to third level. Everybody will recognise the biggest challenge in second level is that you know the examination system. You have largely a prescribed syllabus that you know in advance. you have to turn up for school or you get in trouble in general. And then you go to college. And for many cases, that isn't the case. For a significant number of people, they're away from home, which is a big transition. And one of the transitions, I'd be interested in Maria's experience on this as well, is that in many colleges, almost all now that Trinity have introduced it, are semesterized, which means you hit your first examinations either before or after Christmas. You don't have a lot of time. You don't have the time that was there before. Personally, I think that's a good thing because I think it gets people up and running early. But it is a big transition to move, say, from home, from a Leaving Cert system, where you have to turn up to go to college, a much bigger group, maybe with people that you haven't met before, and within a relatively short period of time that you're hit with a series of examinations. So I do think that the supports that are put in place around that, and there are very simple things that people have done and can do. If I can just anecdotally bring a piece here. Not only science, but law, for instance, in UCD has a common entry system for all the various programmes that they have. One of the interesting things about that, my own daughter is studying law with history as part of that, but she has a class cohort of about 15 people that are studying that particular one. She's in with all the law students for the rest, but she automatically, relatively early on, has a small group that she can become friends with. 63% of people who don't complete college don't transition from first to second year. You lose most of the people at the start. There are a small number of things that the institutions can put in place, like these maths clinics that allow people acclimatise and acculturate to higher education. They're simple things to do, but they've, I think, have a huge impact on the progression and retention rate.
And I can, you know, recognise that myself as somebody that completed a BA, an arts degree, but actually it was in public and social policy, which meant we had a smaller cohort of, you know, an actual class as well, you know, of kind of 30 to 40 students, aside from being in the huge general BA arts mix. But can I just bring you in, perhaps, Maria, just on some of those points there that Baldrick mentioned?
So there's undoubtedly, I think that the thing that when you come in, there's a very quick turnaround from the day you get your Leaving Cert points till the day you're given your place, till the day you start. You're almost, it's like a 2 or 3 week period. And I think sometimes students, when they come in initially and the sun is shining and it's September and the Leaving Cert, it's kind of, oh yeah, I did great in my Leaving Cert. And actually it comes as a bit of a shock 3 weeks in. Here's our first assignment. Here's our first quiz. And that first semester can be really intense. And I think we know that as well. So often the teaching approaches we would take in that first semester of first year, we're trying to kind of have a bridge or a scaffold for the student coming from a system where, like, their time has been managed for them. The teacher is the person who has kind of measured out the content. We'll do this by then and we'll be prepared by then. And really, they have to start now the transition to taking control of their own learning. But I think we're aware of that and we do try to scaffold it. We also have things like, you know, as what you may well be in a class with 300. That's undoubtedly one of the things that'll happen in first year, and it can seem daunting, and you were the best in your class and now you're in
nobody knows you.
Nobody knows you, but you were the best and you knew that, but now you're in a class where everyone has been the best in their classes, and particularly if, you know, you were away from home, it's a huge thing. So we have, I suppose, academic and other pastoral support. So we have a peer mentoring system where the second and third year students in the same programme would mentor maybe a small group of first years as well. I think things like labs and tutorials are great places for students to get to know each other.
And just on that kind of testing model, the sort of the teach, you know, allow the students to learn and then test them quite quickly, and, you know, perhaps before Christmas or Halloween period. What's your kind of view on that sort of teaching model?
So that is something, I mean, with semesterization, that's an inevitable.
That's
so you have
okay.
two semesters. It's a 12 weeks term. There's a week study break and then there's exams, and that's just the way the semester system works. I think one of the things, you know, we did when we took over semesterization, and I think first years really like this, might be little small frequent low stakes tests every week just to get them to transfer over. But I mean, I think that's something that I know in UCD anyway, we're looking at is the amount of assessments we do, the timing of them. So certainly we have to assess 6 modules before Christmas. But how we do that, I think we could be more creative, and that's something we're looking at the minute.
John Walsh, what's your view? Sure.
Well, students, when they go to third level, have to take greater responsibility for their own learning. And we'd like to see more of that in secondary schools, having greater responsibility and taking on, rather than being spoon-fed for exams and focusing solely on gaining points. And that was sort of the basis for some of the reforms suggested for junior cycle. You know, they were considerably watered down. And there's now discussion about what will happen for changes in the leaving at senior cycle up to the leaving certificate. It's going to be a very slow process. So to change kind of the mindset of the students, their parents and the teachers indeed, who like everything planned out for them. I mean, it's ridiculous when you have nearly a national crisis if an unpredicted question comes up in English in the leaving certificate, or if the maths question threw students off their kilter. It's almost a national crisis. And we do actually in Ireland give a huge amount of media attention, and I'm as guilty as anybody else or my colleagues, to the exams and preparation for exam results. But in discussion of the transition from second to third level, I think we should not overlook the fact that about 16% of leaving certificate students don't apply to the CAO. And we tend to equate the leaving certificate solely as a filtering mechanism for higher education.
And funny, we did that here on the programme actually 2 weeks ago, when we spent quite a bit of time even specifically talking about the internships and also the postgraduate programmes as well that are on offer. Because I think, no more than you mentioned, John, a lot of people, they just sometimes aren't fully aware of what's actually
indeed, out there. Yeah, I mean, when I did the leaving cert, people asked you, well, how did you get on in the leaving? No, nobody asked that. They say, how many points did you get?
Everything's points based.
Yeah, except it's much more confusing with the new point system. You might have 461 rather than 460.
I was looking at some of the interesting stats, actually, just with regards to completion rates at college. And one of the areas, I suppose, computer science, when we talk about countering dropout rates and non-progression and non-completion rates, and even just in terms of a gender balance as well. But looking at stats from the Higher Education Authority, computer science is sort of one of the areas where there's a large number, 45% of students actually doing computing science didn't go on to finish it, and men more likely actually to drop out there than women. Just in your own perspective, John, or Padraig Walsh, I should say, from the quality and qualifications side of things, just why does that happen?
First of all, we shouldn't beat ourselves up on this. Internationally, Ireland performs extremely well in terms of completion. The same OECD study that looked at that, if you look at the United States, for instance, 55% of people who start a bachelor's degree in the US don't finish it. Another OECD country like New Zealand, 45% don't complete. We're talking about completion rates here in the well above 80% that we have in Ireland as an average. So we have a very good system relative to most international countries in terms of our completion rates. We have challenges around particular disciplines. In terms of computer science, I would guess, and in many cases, what the challenge is that people, A, don't know what they're getting into, that their understanding of what computer science is around gaming and other things like that. It's very hard to do many computer science courses without a good mathematics background. So people will be introduced to mathematics. It's not just mathematics. There are a whole load of other programs. People, for instance, doing commerce in UCD will think, oh, this is just a business program. Significant amount of mathematics that's involved in that. It's well telegraphed in the syllabus if people look and prepare for it. But that is a challenge, that sometimes people don't know what they're getting into within that. And the other is, I suppose, the balance between the supply-demand system that we have. The points for a program are set by the demand for the course. They're not necessarily set by the level of difficulty that's in the particular program.
Yeah, they're not reflective of how...
It's hard to see how, for instance, some of the language programs or English or history or law really demand people who need 500 and something points. But the demand for the program is such that you get very high-skilled people going in. On the other hand, where you tend to have more of the vacant or less demanding places, actually tend to be some of the more challenging courses. That's why you have challenges in construction, in engineering and in computer science. I'd say in the computing case, it's probably people not really understanding what the program is. I think, however, there are many types of computing programs, and people could do with looking at whether it's an applications program or a gaming program. Like everything else in life, prepare in advance, read the syllabus, have a look at what you have to do. Because to be honest, most of the prospectus are pretty honest. They tell you if there is a level of mathematics required for that.
I think it's particularly a problem for some of the computing courses in the Institutes of Technology, where some students, particularly males, come in with low points. And they will struggle no matter what course they're doing. But if it's a maths-based course, that adds to their difficulty. And as we have seen from that study, which kind of repeats earlier studies, there is a high dropout rate from some of those courses.
In fairness, a lot of courses now, I think, you know, and even specifically, and I know, Maria, that might be an area for yourself, but a lot of courses now will have stipulations in terms of perhaps for a journalism programme that might look for, you know, that perhaps you have to have an honour in honours English, or in maths you have to have a very specific grade to get into the course. Is that a good idea, Maria, to kind of peter out, I suppose, people that just aren't at the right level for that course?
Absolutely. I think it's a case of us being honest. This is what we think you need mathematically to succeed in this course. And I'm often surprised, because I've been in UCD for 22 years, so I've talked to a lot of incoming students. And you might have a student coming up to you and they're asking you about some degree programme that's maybe got mathematics in the title. And you ask, well, what are you doing? I'm doing ordinary level maths. And you say, well, this has a really high component of maths for the four full years of the programme. Why do you think you might be okay? And, oh, okay, I hadn't thought of it like that. And I use the analogy, if you were doing ordinary level Irish, you wouldn't come and do a degree programme in Irish. So there's a little bit, sometimes students might not be realistic. It'll all be okay, and it'll be somehow different when I get to university. So I think by clearly saying you need a minimum H4 in maths or a minimum H2 or whatever it is, we're simply highlighting this is actually what you need. And I think that's essential.
Can I just ask you, just Maria, as well, just on the points we're talking about there in terms of the trying to counter the dropout rates, and I suppose specifically with computing and computer science been one of the areas that was touched on. I know Padraig was saying that it, not to necessarily over-egg the issue, but just what's your view on that?
Well, I think one of the things that's really important, because I was doing a bit of work on this week, the HEA report is actually looking at the cohort that came in 2007. So I think, for example, the retention rate there in first year computer science in UCD was they lost 52%. That's 11 years ago. So we've had 11 more cohorts coming in since then. And if you look at the more recent figures, it has completely turned around, for example, in UCD. And the retention rates are now the same as the other programmes on the university. They're on a par with those. So, you know, there's a lot of factors in that. But so I think while the evidence-based reporting is the only way to go, it's the only way we can inform practice in Ireland, we do need to remember that actually that cohort came in 11 years ago. So there's been a lot of change since then.
Without wishing to blame anyone for an analogy, if you're looking at completion studies or progression studies, the standard thing that one looks at is you wait for 1.5 times the standard degree length before you look at it. So you need 6 years to look at it, and then you need to do the research. So it's not that it's out of date, that it's impossible really to do proper longitudinal research on progression and completion without looking at a cohort that started a significant period back.
Just John Walsh, before we do the break, just on the point.
Okay, but Park is right. I mean, our dropout rates are lower than other developed countries. But one interesting point was raised, and I might raise it here, at a seminar during the week by Dirk Van Dam. He's from the OECD. And he was referring to a study done in 2012 called the PIAC, which looks at the assessment of the competencies of adults in terms of literacy, numeracy and problem-solving ability. But he reminded people that study showed that 6% of Irish graduates were functionally illiterate. I mean, this is higher than in a lot of other OECD countries. And I suppose we really have to ask ourselves, why is this? Now, you could say that this is an older age group, that their literacy skills declined because they weren't using them, because the adults measured were up to 65 years of age. But I think it's a challenging question, and maybe Pádraig might like to deal with it.
Well, I mean, I can go back and look at the PIAC study. That is obviously a worrying thing. However, if you actually look at the data for some of the other countries, that low rate of attainment at level one for literacy skills, Ireland still has less people in that cohort than the United States, than England and than Australia. That's a challenge. It's not somewhere that people want to be on that. But
there's a couple of different areas I want to turn to in a few moments, and perhaps Pádraig, more specifically related to your own area in terms of the number of courses that are currently on offer to students in the third level system. But before we do that, I just want to come to, I suppose, one key area, and that's around the idea of funding and the standard of our third level institutes that we have, be it ITs and universities. Can I just maybe get you, John, just for people listening today, just in brief, if you can, the Peter Castles report, the chair of the expert group from 2016, that report, the government, of course, he'd warned them that decisions and actions are actually needed now before we have a kind of a stalemate, basically, in higher education funding, if we want to try and limit the further impact on students. Just that report in a nutshell.
Well, if we go back to the recession, I mean, during the really bad days when we were facing a financial disaster, we need to remind ourselves of that. Cuts were introduced across the whole public sector. Primary and secondary fared okay because teachers were continued to be appointed, but third level was really very badly hit, and the spending per student plummeted, and a lot of the staff were not either replaced. The staff student ratio rose to a very high level, so we really were and still are facing into a financial crisis. Cassell's report pointed out the extent of that crisis and came up with a number of suggestions. It looked at various options. But basically what it suggested was a loan scheme should be introduced, whereby students would borrow if they had to go to college. They would pay fees, not astronomical fees as they have in the UK, £9,250 a year, or in some of the American universities you could be paying $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000. We weren't talking about a massive increase, but certainly an increase from the current rate of $3,000 a year. You would borrow and then pay that back. The problem with that was it might work in theory, but in practice politics comes into it and it's been kicked down the road again and again.
And it's still there, and nothing has been done about it, because that's
I can't see anybody promising a loan scheme in the next general election, whether it comes this year or next year.
Okay, but I suppose it's interesting because we have the Peter Castles report, and then I suppose Pádraig Walsh. At the same time, we constantly have these discussions every quarter, I've no doubt, on every Irish radio station, where we hear about the Irish Education Institutes slipping down the rankings. So how do we try and balance that between we need more money, otherwise university rankings are going to keep slipping? At the same time, nobody wants to bring in the loan system. So how do we kind of steady out the seesaw a little bit?
Okay, then the first things to do is to look at rankings. Rankings, international rankings, largely measure research quality. That tends to be the main indicator that people are using on those. So they're really a measure of either research income, research output, in terms of papers, etc. They do include proxy measures like class size, pupil-teacher ratio. That's one of the reasons why Irish universities slip down. Someone asked me once about, is the quality diminishing? And I said, what I can tell you is that Irish universities will slide down league tables simply because one of the metrics that's used is class size. If you increase the number of students, which we did over that period, while reducing the number of staff, which we also did, automatically you're going to fall down on a particular indicator. But it is important to recognise that to a large extent they're research measures that people are looking. It's not that we shouldn't pay attention to them, but in terms of largely when people are talking about quality, they're talking about the quality of undergraduate
it's
teaching.
Not so much an indicator of the quality of the teaching within the college.
You can make an argument that it's easier to do certain things with smaller class sizes, which it is. If you look at in primary and secondary school at pupil teacher ratios, the actual number that comes out of that is not the number of people on average that are in a class. They tend to come with the number on the basis of the number of special needs assistants and supports that are in there. So the sort of things that you lose out on when you have increased students are the ability to do things like, for instance, final year research projects, where when I was an academic, I would have had 3 or 4 students involved in those. If the numbers go up, you simply can't operate those with 8 people. You don't have the equipment, you don't have the attention to do it. On the actual quality indicators, and QQI, I think, gives a plug in here, we did a report called Quality in an Era of Diminishing Resources, 2008 to 2015. And as the source for that, what we used were the evaluation reports that come out of the departmental and school evaluations it was largely the Irish university sector. And we looked at what external experts were saying in terms of the challenges that were there. What they said were, for instance, they were looking at science departments with an ageing equipment base, which means that your students, when they go out, don't have access to the equipment that they might expect to see when they go out into industry. It looked at things like reduced chance to get involved in research, which essentially is our pipeline for the master's and PhD students, because you can't devote that particular resource. And it looked at, for instance, the choice that people have. You look at a big university like UCD and you think that losing 10 or 15 staff, well, you know, you can suffer that loss. However, and you know from your own background, there are specialisms in the mathematics department that Maria's in there. There are a limited number of people look at the mathematics of education or education in mathematics. If you lose those and can't replace those, you diminish the quality of the offering that people have. All of those accumulate over time in terms of the quality of the graduate.
I'm going to
experience.
Come to you, Maria, on that in just a moment. But just John Walsh, how much do you think we should pay to the fact that third level institutes are dropping in the college rankings?
Well, it does have an impact internationally on both on students and on investors. I mean, foreign direct investment does. I mean, some of these big employers in boardrooms in America do look at the relative standing. No, as Parik says, they are flawed. They're seriously flawed, the rankings, and they can be manipulated. But they are, unfortunately, taken pretty seriously internationally.
When you say manipulated, do you mean in terms of how they're interpreted?
And how they're interpreted, yeah, and also what the categorization of which some staff or students are put into. I mean, I'm aware of situations, not necessarily in Ireland, where students at a lower level were not counted as full higher education students. There have been other practices and other that have been reported elsewhere that you'd have to question whether they really are accurate or not. But to come to your question, they are taken seriously. I mean, some years ago I was on a mission with the minister. They're called missions, with the minister, looking for students to come to Ireland. And everywhere we went, we were asked, "Well, how are your universities and institutes of technology ranked internationally?" They were really important for some decisions.
You were shaking your head there, Pork Walsh, just on some of those points. Just in terms of, just explain that idea of the, as John talked about it there, just how rankings can be interpreted or, as he said, manipulated.
Rankings are based on a series of things that the compilers decide are of value, and then they're weighted. And then those particular rankings that are within that tend to have a numerator and denominator on it. So there's a whole series of numbers that people look at. And if you're smart, and universities are full of smart people, they look at not how can we manipulate things, but let's look at the drivers, some of those things that we can change. So how you classify, for instance, teaching staff and research staff and ancillary staff can change the number on the top or the bottom of the line and can adjust the figure.
Can I bring you in, Maria Meehan, in some of these points? Because you're obviously actively teaching.
I'm on the ground.
Before the students, I should say. How bothered do you get about college rankings?
So I suppose I'm on the ground. I'm in the School of Maths and Stats. It's my job. I'm a lecturer. I have to do research. And I think while rankings are there and I sometimes hear about them, I think the key one is staff-student ratio. So you can, whatever, if you massage all you want, I see the reality of the staff-student ratio in the classroom. So yes, it's exactly that thing. All of our undergraduates should be doing a research project. It's a great thing. If you have a small class and they get to do quite a substantial research project in their final year. That takes one-on-one supervision or one small group supervision. That is great. And we do try to do it. However, I'm going back to those big first year classes and we've talked about retention. 63% tend to drop out of the people who drop out in the first year. We're, you know, our students can be in front of us in a class of 300, 350. And then it's down to the poor old hard work and academic. How do I somehow make this an individual learning experience for these 300 students? So we have to be creative. We have to bring in, I bring in video to try and supplement my class, let them use it either way. The other thing that's really important is it's fine if you've got 300 homogeneous students in front of you and they've all got a H2 in higher maths. More and more and more, the student cohort is getting more and more diverse. We have people coming in from all entry routes, mature students from the higher education access route, the disability access route, through other access routes, and we have students coming from abroad internationally more and more and more. So,
and that's often where the rankings can be important too.
That is not a one size teach all. You know, one size fits all.
Okay.
So that is the reality of, so massage all you want, the staff-student ratio is a key factor.
And I suppose, and just on those points too, we talk about the Peter Castles report, and one of the points raised there is in terms of the level of funding that the report highlights that would be needed by 2020, somewhere in the region of around €600 million extra a year in terms of extra funding required for the third level sector. But
yeah,
just
it's,
John,
it's interesting actually that figure has now been questioned by the Department of deeper Department of Expenditure and Public Reform. They were trying to work out how exactly that figure was arrived at, and there is some. I'm sorry to say, because I've great respect for Peter and the work he did, but there is some official in officialdom at least. The figure is being queried about the necessity for that amount.
Did you want to come in on that, on the Castles report, I suppose, and the delay in terms of, well, we talked about the political hot potato that any introduction of students' loans would be pork.
But I always remind people that the Blair government in Britain nearly fell on an issue. It wasn't the Iraq war. It was on the introduction of top-up tuition fees. Funding for higher education is a hot potato in every country. It's a challenge in most of the big OECD countries. What has happened in the UK in relation to the student loan system is that the loan book has been sold on, I think, about three times now, because the default rate, and remember, those loans are income contingent loans, so you don't have to pay it back until your income goes over a certain amount, which is, and many people will not pay those back. Ultimately, the taxpayer ends up funding those. There's been a real challenge in the UK system around the student loan system. And I think people have seen that here. And I think our government have seen that here, quite rightly. No one is going to go into an election campaigning for increased fees again. However, there has been some movement on this. There has been an increase in the National Training Fund, for instance, which was a fund that was in surplus, which is a levy on employers that largely used to go to fund things like apprenticeship, which has now been broadened across the third level sector. That will, and there's a challenge, I suppose, for some people around this, that will, people believe, mean that there will be an entitlement on some of those people to call for the value in what money that they're actually being levied to do that. But there has been an increase in funding through that particular route. There has been some capital funding, and that is another area where there's a big challenge. But in many cases there, the universities, for instance, have been able to borrow through the European Investment Bank to be able to fund some of the capital development projects. To date, that isn't really an option for the Institutes of Technology. But of course, there, many of those are on their own journey, as you know, amalgamating into technological universities, and the expectation would be that they would be allowed to go through a borrowing framework.
I suppose the idea of student fees and further funding allocations for third level institutes, it's something that we will be talking about again. I just want to focus on a final part of the show today, specifically around the quantity and the quality of courses and programmes that are available to students at the moment. It was something that was actually raised in our programme 2 weeks ago with regards to the second level system, and I suppose the focus on fifth and sixth year students to identifying a course they want to get into and trying to get through the Leaving Cert to get that course. One of the things that always strikes me, John Walsh, though, is around the time of the Leaving Cert course options every year, you get the big supplement in the Irish Times and you can go through all of the different points that are allocated to each course, and it's the amount of courses, you know, the plethora of programmes that are out there for students. It's incredible, the amount of courses, I think, out there today.
Yeah, you get a similar supplement in the Irish Independent. an even better one. Yes, you're quite right. I mean, there's been an inexorable rise in the number of course options for students over the past two decades. And it is, I think, confusing for students. We have about 41, 42 institutions in the central application system. Some universities, in particular UCD and Maynooth, have been to the fore in broadening the first year to an all-embracing science or law or whatever, and allowing students to pick and choose later. I think more institutions should do that.
To allow the students pick up at a later
stage? At a later date, yeah, because it postpones, I mean, they can sample different types of science or engineering, computing, and they get to know where their strengths are, where their interests are, and they also get to understand the particular options better than looking at them from a six-year point of view and okay. trying to figure out, well, what exactly will this course mean?
You're in agreement there, Maria. You're shaking your head.
John has already mentioned this, and I keep going back. It's a great report that Áine Hyland wrote in 2011, the Transitions Report, mm-hmm. and it was a joint venture between the Higher Education Authority and the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. And this is one of the things that was really recommended in this report, that we have more general entry courses. So you come in, we take in four or five hundred students, and it's from that you can move into several different degrees. Because I always say, when I'm talking to a Leave and Cert student at an open night, and they can come in, and I think at best some of them can say, I love biology, I love maths, or I love economics and maths. And, you know, based on what they've seen at school, the third level sector should be able to say, well, it's enough, we know you love biology and we know you love maths. That's fine. That's all we need to know now. For example, you do science, you can specialise in biology immediately, or you can taste it, and we'll ask you to make that more informed decision mm-hmm. a year or two down the road. And I think, you know, for the example I always take is, say, before we went general entry, a Leave and Cert student might have had to decide, do I want to do a degree in neuroscience, microbiology, biochemistry or pharmacology? Now, you know, I don't know how. I mean, sometimes I'll ask students, how do you know you want to do that? And they'll say, well, my sister does it. Mm. So that's fine. But on the whole, they'll say, I don't know. You know, maybe somebody said it to me. So it's up to us actually to fill that gap. Okay. If we know you like biology, let us do the rest. And in the first 2 years, you taste a bit of micro and bio and pharmacology. And when you make the decision that you're going to do a four-year degree in that, you will be well informed, because you'll already have seen what it's like at universities. Even something like maths, students might say, well, I love maths. And it's often good, well, actually come study with us for a year, see how you like it at university. You know what? You might really like statistics. You might like applied and computational maths. These are other things you might not have done at school. So I think that really is a way that the student doesn't have to make decisions that I honestly don't know how you could try and make when you're 18 or 19.
Can I say something in defence of the institutions? If you go back through the history on this, I'll show my age here, I filled out the first set of CAO forms in 1977. I didn't go down the list because there simply weren't enough courses for me to look at. I wanted to study engineering. I had two choices if I wanted to stay at home, go to UCD or Trinity. That's all there was. To some extent, the quality of the education that I received was down to the level of how hard they had to get me to come in the first place. Nowadays, it is much more competitive. And I think people have to recognise that people are in a market and that institutions are competing for talent. Mm. If you look at the completion rates that we have, 95% of students who get between 500 and 550 points complete. 43% complete if they get between 205 and 250. The biggest determinant of whether you're going to complete your degree usually is around the entry standard of the person going in. So the institutions are competing for those. Institutions looking at that. So what is one of the best ways of doing this? The more programmes you have that have high points cutoffs, you can do this. And depending on the institution, you can do that by taking in small cohorts into that. Okay. So people have thought for a period of time, I'm going into a class of 10 to arrive in first year and find that they're in a biology class with 550 people.
Can I just ask though, are we not, you know, qualifying and graduating too many? I suppose in my own field, I'm obviously working in the journalism arena. I mean, like, there's just any amount of host of journalism programmes and courses and diplomas and degrees and whatever you want that you can do. And we have all of these people with, you know, say, for instance, journalism backgrounds, and just don't have the jobs for them. And I just wonder, have we too many courses out there, and also too many courses, even arts degrees, I see in many cases now, are being run over a four-year period. Mine was over a three-year period. And it's the additional cost on everybody for doing this, you know?
There are. I do think we have to take a wider look at this. I don't understand the idea of telling young people you're going to work with 20 jobs till you're 80 and then say, let's get you through college really quickly. You know, there is a huge value in spending 4 years in university. And I actually think that people don't put enough credit about what you actually come out with. If you look at what are termed learning outcomes at the end of that process, you evaluate a 22-year-old who's coming out of university on a four-year degree on the basis of what they've learned, what knowledge, skill and competence that they've gained. But you can only attribute a certain amount of that to the actual academic function that they've had. There is a real value in my I've two girls, one who's finished college, one who's in second year. Part of the value of them growing up has given them a period of time in which they haven't had to have a full-time job, in which they can explore to do things. Most of the soft skills that they've learned, whether the universities like it or not, are in fact not what they learn in the classroom. Mm. It's what they're able to do in the summers. It's what they're able to do if they do part-time work. I think there is a real value in spending time in terms of the quality of your... There's a real value. Many of those four-year programmes actually have an internship.
Yeah, well, that's a new thing.
Year.
And I know that wasn't
and that is
there
a huge
in my day.
Plus
yeah,
in terms yeah. of a person's output when okay. they've gone out.
Just very briefly before we finish, just if I can ask you both, John and Maria, just to comment on Peter's points, just on that idea of the benefit of having the additional year in college and also the number of programmes out there?
Well, the number of programmes I think is too many. I mean, I'm not sure how many 17-year-olds know what mechatronics engineering is. You probably do, Porrick. So I actually favour common entry to engineering, in particular in science and the sciences. But in terms of young people going to college, if you think about it, many of the children being born now will live into their 80s and 90s mm. and will probably... maybe even longer, and many of them will work until their 70s and 80s. So they're going to have to be prepared for a rapidly
changing...
Oh, I'm
preparing to work till I'm about 90, actually.
to secure your pension.
For exactly a mortgage or payments, yeah.
Yeah. So it's ideal if they can stay in college for 4 years. Okay. It's not always possible. It's expensive.
Most of your courses, Maria, are probably that 4 or 5 year programme.
They're 4 or 5 year programme. And I think the real benefit there is we have now things like exchanges to other countries. So that can be part of it for a semester. We have the internships. And I think the other thing you can do in a 4 year programme that you can't really do in a 3 is you can integrate research skills. And they are really important skills that you can transfer to any domain when you graduate. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a real benefit from the 4 year degree.
Certainly a lot of employers are looking for as well. It's been a fascinating discussion. And my thanks to you all for joining us this morning. Associate Professor Maria Meehan from the UCD School of Maths and Statistics, John Walsh, education journalist, and also Porrick Walsh, who's the CEO of Quality and Qualifications Ireland. That's all we have time for today. If you've missed any of the programme, you can download our podcast on newstalk.com on our website, or you can search for it on Newstalks Between the Lines in iTunes or any other podcast player. My thanks to the production team this morning, Simon Keane and Stephen Jordan. Bobby Kerr is up next. Between the Lines will be back again next Sunday morning from 8. I'll also be back again with a breakfast briefing on Monday morning from 6 a.m. But for me, Andrea Gilligan, have a great day.
Between the Lines on News Talk.